Just like last week, due to the pretty heavy length of the passage, we'll go ahead and just tackle it together in due time this morning. Whenever we have passages like this, I'm always interested in asking that question, what is the Bible about? We all have Bibles. Maybe they're on our pockets right now on our phones. Maybe we brought our Bibles. Maybe we forgot them at home, or it's even sitting in our car right now in the parking lot. But we have Bibles, and so maybe you've had this conversation. I've had a number of times where someone says, like, what's the Bible about? And like a lot of the basic questions of life, it can be kind of hard to answer, right? What is the Bible about? Many efforts have been made to say what the Bible is about. Principles of God the living, I think that leaves a lot to be desired. Consists of God's law, God's a prescription on what it is and how to be human. Propositions, like truth statements. The Bible consists of truth statements on who God is and what he has done. And they open up our Bibles to where we're at right now, with David and Goliath last week. Today's the aftermath of David and Goliath. We're in the middle of a book like 1 Samuel, and all of those kinds of answers just seem to leave something desired, because we have something a lot more than just truth statements on who God is and even what we're to do. Even the Westminster Shorter Catechism, which is great. I mean, catechism is like a question and answer forum on how we understand and think through our system of doctrine, what the Bible teaches. And so the Shorter Catechism says, well, what do the scriptures contain? And they say the scriptures principally teach what who God is and what we are to believe concerning God. And that's a good answer. But even then, I think it's leaving something that's missing when we come to a passage like 1 Samuel 18. So what is the Bible? It's really a story. It's a story of how God has dealt with his creation, through our history, like the same world that we live in, how God has dealt with his creation, related through his creation, in this thrilling historical drama. It's a thrilling historical drama, and this drama finds its apex, it finds its climax, when the story says that God became man in order to redeem fallen men and women, in order to save them from their sins, to make them children of God. What's always fascinating to me is that God could have just given us a list of principles. We could have had these kind of ideas float down from the heavens. He could have just given his law and said, well, this is what you're supposed to do, figure it out. But he gave us these stories that are so long that we were sitting down right now. We're not even reading the text. They're that long. Why? I'll offer a couple reasons why, at least why I think he gave us these stories. First of all, we have to slow down. That's what stories do. They slow us down. We want the good stuff, right? We want the meat. And God says, that's not how human beings work. We know that's not how human beings work. We have to slow down because we are not data processors. We're not machines. We don't run zeros and ones through our brain. And instead, we are image-bearing human beings who have hearts and minds that are moved and shaped by story. We speak the language of story. If you have a family, you have stories. If you're part of a culture, you share more than just a language and tradition and cuisine. You share collective stories. Every culture, including ours, for better, maybe a little bit for worse, we are all the most influential voices in our culture are our storytellers. We'd call that Hollywood in our culture. Those are the most influential voices, our storytellers. It's not surprising that God has revealed his word to us in a form that matters, like, to our humanity, story. Where are we in this thrilling drama? Because that's where we are. And the burden I feel when we have a text like 1 Samuel 18 is to, like, convey this as a story, right? To not say, here are the 3 points that we need to take from today, but to bring us all into this story, to slow down and chew on why God has given us this as his word. So where are we in this thrilling drama? Let me catch us all up real quick. Israel desires a king like the nations, and they get one. They get tall, beautiful, handsome, striking King Saul. And Saul likes one thing about being king. He likes the he likes the power and authority. He doesn't like the responsibility. And he doesn't like being a king in subjection to the ultimate king, king of the universe, the Lord. He rejects the Lord, so the Lord rejects him. The kingdom is ripped from his hands, and this unlikely successor has been secretly appointed. He's from Bethlehem. Bethlehem is like a backwoods town of backwoods towns. You know Bethlehem is backwoods because at the time, there are two Bethlehems in Israel. There's a Bethlehem near Jerusalem. That's where King David is born. It's where Jesus will be born. There's also a Bethlehem in the north. So it's a bad start to say, I'm from Bethlehem. And the follow-up question is, which one? That's David. That's the new king of Israel. He's the youngest son of eight boys. He's a shepherd. But he's brought into King Saul's court because Saul has some kind of mental struggles right now. He has depression. He has anxiety. He is troubled right now. He's tormented right now. And the only thing that can soothe him is music. And David is this gifted lyre player, this portable harpist, this guitar player. And he comes and he soothes the mind of Saul. Last week, we looked at what is easily the most famous story in all of the Bible, David and Goliath. Everyone cowers in fear at the tall, strong warrior Goliath, but David is indignant that Goliath would mock Israel and therefore mock Israel's God. And so David goes to battle on behalf of Israel with a sling and five stones, takes the giant warrior out, and the Israelite army is mobilized and they fight successfully, at least for this battle, against the Philistines. Now, prior to David stepping in, Saul makes an offer, and this is important for today. He says, you'll be rich, you'll marry one of my daughters, and your family will be exempt from service to the royal house. And so after David is successful, we didn't look at this last week, but after David is successful, we come to the end of chapter 17, and Saul asks Abner, his commander, he said, whose son is this youth? Speaking of David. Now, Saul knows who David is. He loves David. David is his musician. David gets promoted to being his arms bearer. So why in the world is he asking, after the David and Goliath conflict, why is he asking, whose son is this? Some think the editors and compilers of 1 Samuel were just getting sloppy at this point. You have two traditions of David, you have two myths of David, and all of a sudden they conjoin here, but it's sloppy. You have two introductions of David. I don't think that's right. Because look closely. He's not asking who David is. He's asking who his father is. Because David is moving, after his victory with Goliath, he's moving from court musician and court attendant to prince. And so the natural question is, if this guy's going to be family, who is he? My children are young right now, but I can imagine if my daughter comes back from college and she has a boyfriend who she's smitten with, one of the questions I will ask is, well, do you know about his family? What's his family like? Who exactly are we bringing in? What I want you to grasp as we open up 1 Samuel 18 is this shift. This is key. It's a shift of who David is perceived to be. He's unknown court attendant to celebrity, and it happens overnight. He's a nobody from a nothing town to a national hero. And what we see are two radically different responses to the rise of David. On the one hand, one of the repeated words in this chapter is love. Jonathan, Saul's son, loves David. All of Israel and Judah love David. Michal, Saul's daughter, loves David. And then there's Saul, who used to love David, but now Saul is moving from suspicion to fear to dread. And by the time the chapter ends, he fears David more than when it first began. So we have in chapter 18, three scenes, or three acts of our drama, three acts of love and war. Three scenes of those who love David contrasted with the growing resentment and fear of Saul. Act 1, David and Saul's son. Act 1, David and Saul's son. You got your Bibles open. This is also printed for you in your bulletins. Let us read verses 1 through 4. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan strips himself of that robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. This is a brief scene, but there is a lot going on here. We have Saul's son Jonathan, who is pledging his allegiance. He is pledging his love to David. Where does the love come from? Jonathan sees in David this kindred soul. It's a kindred soul who loves the Lord. He sees someone in David who shares his values. He sees someone who goes to battle in the name and the strength of the Lord. And what should be really obvious in Israel at this time is that that is very rare. It's very rare in Israel at this time that anyone loves the Lord or gives glory to the Lord. So when Jonathan sees David fight Goliath and David says, I'm doing this in the name of the Lord, the God of heaven's armies, Jonathan says, I see a faith that I recognize. Back in 1 Samuel 14, Jonathan takes his armor bearer and he sneaks out of the Israelite camp and he goes to an armed Philistine garrison. And Jonathan does this because he knows two things. He knows the Lord of Israel is God and he knows the Lord is with him. So Jonathan sees David before Goliath, and Jonathan sees this faith that he knows in himself. He sees someone that he admires. He sees someone that looks at the world the same way he does. He sees David and says, I want to be friends with that guy. It's like friendship 101, isn't it? It's that connection you make with someone because they like the same obscure band that you like, and no one else knows that band. You say, oh, we could be friends already. We follow the same sports team. We can be friends. We enjoy the same hobbies. What's fascinating to me is that Jonathan is considerably older than David. Most paintings of the two of them or Sunday school illustrations always have them depicted as peers. But Jonathan is at least 20 years older than David. He's at least 20 years older. So if David is around 20 at this time, which he probably is, then Jonathan is somewhere between 40 and 50. And Jonathan knits his soul to this young man. And he says, I want to be your best friend. And they do become best friends. He loves him. He loves him. What I think is one of the most beautiful pictures in the Bible has, not even in recent years, this has been around for a while, it's been fodder for some really harmful interpretation. Jonathan loves David, and David loves Jonathan, and the only place that we can go right now in our current moment is that this has to be romantic love. Has to be romantic. No two men can love each other as much as David and Jonathan do without there being some romantic angle, but I think that interpretation says far more about us than it does Jonathan and David. C.S. Lewis, in his great book, The Four Loves, 70 years ago, wrote this. 70 years ago. Those who cannot conceive friendship as a substantive love, as like a meaningful love, but only as disguise or elaboration of eros, of sexual, romanticized love, betray the fact that they have never had a friend. Culturally, we are at a moment of near crisis when it comes particularly to male friendship. Female friendship isn't far behind, but male friendship right now is at a point in crisis. In the academic journal, New Directions for Child Adolescence, one author, a scientist, wrote this. She said, we face something of a crisis when we gender and sexualize a socio-emotional need that is essential for our survival. Fewer and fewer young people report having friends. And the mental health numbers and suicide rates are staggering. It's been suggested, and this is for men, it says that the numbers state that loneliness and friendlessness have the same effect on mortality as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And the Bible gives us this beautiful picture of friendship between two men, a relationship that is a gift to them. This relationship will sustain them through hard times. It's a picture for us to commend to our sons. It's a picture to commend to our daughters. Because again, female friendship isn't far behind male friendship in this current age. But there is something else going on here than just two guys beginning a friendship. There's something political going on here. In fact, the word for love can be used in a political context for giving allegiance to a ruler, giving your love to a ruler. And so Jonathan makes a covenant with David. He strips himself of his robe. He gives it to David along with his armor and his sword and his bow and his belt. Well, what's going on there? Flashback to last week. Saul calls David into his presence right before he fights Goliath in order to do what? To clothe David with his armor and helmet and sword, but David refuses the armor of the king. He refuses to go into battle as a king of the nations. He refuses to go into battle as an extension of Saul. But in this scene, David takes the armor. David rejected the armor of Saul. He rejected fighting the giant as a king of the nations, trusting in weapons, trusting in tactics, but he takes the armor of Jonathan, who fights just like he does in the power of the Lord. More importantly, though, he takes Jonathan's robe. What's Jonathan doing here? This isn't Jonathan and David sharing clothes. I would grant that would be a little strange. No, it's Jonathan unofficially abdicating from his right to the throne. That throne that belongs to me when my dad dies, I am giving it to you, David. It's Jonathan, the next in line, saying, no, one greater than me is here, and I'm giving him my allegiance. I mean, this is setting us up for the kind of humility and love and service in the New Testament when David's greater descendant is exalted by his older cousin, John the Baptist. I must decrease so that you may increase. I'm not worthy to tie his sandals. And Jonathan stands before David and declares he is unworthy of the royal robes that he sees as belonging rightfully to his younger friend. Jonathan decreases so David may increase. David has secretly been anointed as Israel's king. And yet his throne will not come by way of revolution. It will not come by coup. It will come through Jonathan giving up what belongs to Jonathan. What do we take away from this first act? Do you love Jesus? That's what I take away. Do you love Jesus? We talk a lot about loving Jesus, right? We would say, if you're a Christian, I hope you say, I love Jesus. But we have to also admit, what does it mean to love Jesus? Right? It's like the Jesus is my boyfriend songs. How do we express our love for Jesus? What does it mean to love Jesus? Love is a tricky word. We know that in English, it means just about everything. We may be able to say we know what it's like to love family or to love our spouses, but what in the world does it mean to love Jesus? This scene is what it means to love Jesus. Because Jonathan loves David, which means that Jonathan sees in David someone he would say, you are worth fighting for. You are worth fighting with. You are worth my allegiance. To love David, Jonathan is saying, I'm going to tie my existence up with you. That's how important and amazing I think you are. And that's a great picture of the love of a disciple, isn't it? I love Jesus. What does that mean? It means that Jesus is worth it. That in this world of rival kings and rival allegiances, rival rulers of our hearts and minds, we say, no, I love Jesus. He's worth attaching my life to. He's worth going into the trenches for. He's someone worthy of allegiance. And he is worthy, as we'll keep seeing. He is the king. He is the king that rules and reigns with perfect justice. He is the king that is worthy of our love. Act 1, David and Saul's son. Act 2, David and Saul's nation. Again, Act 1, with a brief but powerful story of Jonathan pledging his love, his commitment to David. Act 2 is much longer and deals with Israel's love of David. In verse 5, we read that David went out. That's the Hebrew way of saying that he went to war. He went out. He's successful. And so Saul gives him a promotion. David is set over what are called the men of war, which means he's the leader of the king's special forces. He's like the equivalent of a commander of Navy SEALs or Green Berets. And the people of Israel are loving it. They're eating this guy up. It's good in the sight of the people. It's good in the sight of Saul's servants. Everything David does is met with immediate success. Everything he touches turns to gold. Act 2 begins when David returns from one of these expeditions, and all of a sudden these women come out with their tambourines and all of their instruments, and they sing in verse 7, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And then we read, the story changes. And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. What more can this guy take from me? He can just have the kingdom. And then we read, Saul eyed David from that day on. Saul's consumed with envy. The women who came out with their victory song, they're the women after in Exodus 15 who come out and they sing the song of Moses. This is the ancient Near Eastern version of We Are the Champions. And what is absolutely clear here, what's clear here if you know Hebrew poetry, is that this song was celebrating both David and Saul. This song is not pitting them against them. The small number comes first because it has to, because that's a convention of Hebrew poetry. So what the song ultimately is communicating is that Saul and David together are victorious and have killed 10,000s. That's the plain meaning of the song. And so you can envision another leader grabbing David's hand, holding that hand up, and accepting that song in triumph. But what does Saul do? Saul hears that song, and he says, what does he want next, my throne? This story is a story of two spirits. Spirit of the Lord that gives life, and the spirit of destruction that tears away at Saul's soul. And it's on display here. God's spirit departs from Saul, and instead of delighting in the achievement of David, someone we're told that he loves. He can only be jealous. He can only be driven by fear. He can only see David as a threat. David, as we'll see over the next few weeks, has a completely different understanding of power. His identity is so rooted in the Lord. His security is so centered on who God is and who God is for David. His future is so assuredly in the hands of his God that even when Saul makes his intentions clear, namely, I want to kill you, David, David refuses to act against his king. David presents for us, even in this story, what it means to have an identity that's shaped by the gospel. To be secure in the Lord, what does that look like? Paul tells us what that looks like in the book of Philippians. He says, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Who can do that? Who can do that? Someone who believes that God is for them. Who can do something? Who can do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit? Who can count others more significant than you? Only the person who believes that God is for them. This scene displays David's security in the Lord and Saul's insecurity in himself. And this dynamic, I would say, is at war with all of us. The refrain throughout this story is that the Lord is with David. When the Lord is with you, you can operate from a place of security and rest. You can parent from that posture of rest. You can teach from rest. You can work on your marriage from rest. You can look at the future from a place of rest. To be secure in the Lord means that all of the measuring and all of the counting is done. And that's the rest that David strives from. That's the rest that we have in the gospel. Act 2 isn't over. See, Saul's first angry at David for receiving credit and praise. And then in verse 9, we read, Saul eyed David from that day on. Saul is now filled with paranoia and suspicion. The next day, Saul's having an issue, though. He has his harmful spirit, and he's raving around the house. David is dutifully playing his lyre. Saul is losing his mind. David drives Saul crazy, but only David can soothe Saul's mind. It's a rough place to be. So Saul comes to a breaking point in his rage. David holds a lyre, Saul holds a spear, and he decides to hurl that spear at David, not once, but twice. The contrast in this scene is striking. David, we read literally in the Hebrew, David has in his hand a lyre, Saul in his hand a spear. Saul becomes another Goliath in the life of David is what that means. Another extraordinarily tall warrior with spear in hand, and yet the king like the kings of the nations with spear in hand is no match for God's anointed king who is only armed with a song. It appears that David doesn't take this personally, though. He chalks it up to Saul's mental state, his mood swings. But Saul's afraid of David and senses in a way that must have felt like his heart being ripped from his chest, he could for the first time, we're told, sense God had left him. God had left him. Saul is desperate as he is confronted with his own mental instability, and yet the continual success and vindication of David is there for him to be reminded of. So what does he do next? He demotes David. Instead of being the king's commander of special forces, he makes him an ordinary commander of thousands. He's now just leading ordinary troops, and that's good for Saul because now he's away from the royal court. He's out to battle. But the Lord is with David and he has success in everything he does. So you know what that means, right? Instead of leading just a small band of elite soldiers, now he leads thousands. And so now his celebrity status is only growing in Israel because now he's commanding and successfully going through battle with thousands. So Saul stands in fearful awe of David, and Israel and Judah's love for David just continues to grow. You know what we call this, right? This is tragicomedy. It's tragicomedy. It's Tom trying to get rid of Jerry. It's the Roadrunner time and again overcoming the coyote's threats. Everything Saul does to minimize or eliminate the presence and significance of David only makes things worse for Saul. The nation is falling in love with their hero. The king is going crazy trying to rid the nation of this one they have fallen in love with. And finally, we turn to Act 3. David and Saul's daughter. Act 1, David and Saul's son. Act 2, David and Saul's nation. Act 3, David and Saul's daughter. This is where the story gets dark. Remember, the one who went up against Goliath was to receive the hand of Saul's daughter in marriage, so he offers David his eldest daughter, Merib. There's a catch. Be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. And then the narrator says this, for Saul thought, let the hand of the Philistines be against David, not my hand. Do you hear the evil in Saul's plan? If you were around last fall, as we preached the first part of 1 Samuel, you know that I interpret Saul as someone so easy to sympathize with. He's such a tragic figure. There's so much empathy because we see ourselves in Saul and the way he acts. He's fearful. He's in over his head. But here we have someone far worse than weak. We have someone wicked. The one who was called by God to fight the Philistines on behalf of Israel as their king wants to use the Philistines for his own good to satisfy his own jealous impulses. And to make things worse, he uses God to do it. Hey, David, you can marry my daughter, but be valiant and fight the Lord's battles. Like Saul cares about the Lord and his battles. But David says, I'm not worthy of your daughter. I'm a nobody. My family are nobodies. And Saul accepts that. He says, fine. He marries Merib off to maybe someone in the aristocracy, and she's out of the picture. But Saul's problems aren't over because Saul, we find out, has another daughter named Michal, and she, don't miss this, she loves David. And I don't know what this means, but one thing interesting is that she is the only woman in all of the Old Testament to love a man. Again, I don't really know what that means, except that she is the only woman in the Old Testament to say that she loves a man. And Saul hears of his daughter's love, because everybody loves David. That's the point of the story. Everybody loves David. He hears of his daughter's love, and the light bulb comes on. Verse 21, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. He wants nothing to do with even thinking about the Philistines when it comes to the glory of the Lord. It's not about national security, but when it's over his own personal position and status, boy, is he interested. And so he approaches David again. You shall now be my son-in-law. And David again tries to say, I'm not worthy. I'm unworthy to be the prince. I'm unworthy to be the king's son-in-law. I don't have the money. I don't have the riches to provide a dowry for someone like the princess of a kingdom. And Saul says, oh, that's okay. I don't want your money. I want something else from you. I want 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And we find out why. That he may be avenged of the king's enemies. Saul's ultimate desire is for David to fall by the hand of the Philistines. Saul is sending David on a suicide mission. It's easy to get up in the strangeness of the request, and I grant that. I can't get over it either. It's a strange request in the way that it sits with us. But it reminds us that Saul knew he was sending David to confront an enemy of God. Because his very request is identifying they are enemies of God. So he knows that. He is sending David to fight the enemy of God. These aren't innocent people. These passages we come to in the Old Testament, they always confront us with these issues of God's justice and his wrath and all of the violence. And we wonder, what exactly is going on here? And yet I would suggest, as we usually do as we work through the Old Testament, that our uncomfortableness with God's justice and wrath is born in a sterilized environment. To be disturbed by the violence of the Old Testament and God's desire for justice and wrath against his enemies is only born in a sterilized environment. Without getting into policy decisions, it's worth, they're certainly worth discussion, but two big stories in our news feeds constantly, right? You have Turkey bombing Kurds in Syria, which include, by the way, heavily Christian populated areas, our brothers and sisters in Christ. And you have China that just continues to increase in their human rights violations, but can I believe in a God who takes vengeance? I bet our Kurdish brothers and sisters can, because they are not living in a sterilized environment like you and I. I would argue the question of how can I come to grips with a God of vengeance, that's a question born from a particular place of privilege. It's a blessing to be in that place of privilege, but it's also a sterile environment, and this is not a sterile world. And so what we have in our passage is Saul, who has no faith and who in fact has twisted his motive, saying to David, go kill 100 Philistines. And this bizarre request reminds us that Saul knows that he's not only using God, violating the third commandment, he's also manipulating David's faith. Uncircumcision, a reminder, these are not just political enemies, these are the enemies of God. David, of course, comes back like only David could do with 200 foreskins. Twice as many Philistines killed. The suicide mission is another example of David's heroics, and this results in even more fear in the heart of Saul. Saul knows unmistakably the Lord is with David. He sees the love of his daughter only increasing for her soon-to-be husband. And verse 29 says, Saul was even more afraid of David, so Saul was David's enemy continually. Simple enough story, right? Let us pray. I'm just kidding. What in the world do we do with this thing? What does it mean for us? Why are we spending time in 1 Samuel 18 today? Two big takeaways I think we can take from this text for us even right now. Above all, this is the story of David driving a sword through the family of Saul. David is not the family friend loved by all. He's not Eddie Haskell. He's got like Jonathan's best friend, Michal's boyfriend, and then dad like hates David. No. There's no neutrality with David. He was either loved or hated. He drove a sword through this family. And of course, another king would come bringing victory and life, and who again, he would also be met with no neutrality, and he would also be one who says, I myself am bringing that sword into this world. As Jesus says in Matthew 10, do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword, for I have come to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a person's enemies will be those of his own household. What's Jesus' point? Whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Jonathan takes the cross of David, so to speak. He gives up everything he has with regards to his status and reputation and inheritance in order to find his life in his younger friend. He will lose his own father by choosing David, and yet he will also find his refuge. And at the end of the story, if you know the end of the story of King David, even after Jonathan is dead, Jonathan's sons will also find their refuge in David. There was no neutrality with David. He was either the deliverer needed or a threat to our false systems of deliverance, and so it is with Jesus. Because Jesus is still a threat to our false systems of deliverance. Jesus is still a threat to our desire for comfort. He's still a threat to our desire to find our status and our security in our finances and money. He's still a threat to our world. He's a threat to our idols. And yet the cost is worth it because he is ultimately worth it. He is ultimately worth it. The second point is how the story ends. It's easy to get lost in how off-putting the request is. And I would also argue here, this is careful Old Testament reading, that most of the time when these really bizarre things happen, notice how God actually isn't present right now. Saul is using God and he's manipulating David. But God is not sanctioning any of this, which is a very important point. A very careful reading of the Bible is a reminder that this is not about God's sanctioning of everything. That's the first point. But I want to end here, and this is very important. What I'd rather focus on is the tragedy of this request that Saul makes to David, especially with how it will be repeated. What strikes me about this scene, remember you have the king of Israel who is sending a military commander into a suicide mission for his own benefit. You hear that? Because there's another Israelite king who would send his commander into a suicide mission against Israel's enemy for his own benefit. And that Israelite king, of course, is David. And that commander was Uriah. That commander was the husband of Bathsheba after she got pregnant, who he would send into battle to die. How does that sit with you? Saul failed in the suicide mission that he commanded. David succeeded. David is a king who surpasses Saul in every way. He's a hero of the people. He's loved by the people. He's got this zeal for God that would result in faithful service and a book of prayers that from nearly the time they were composed, with minimal exceptions, have been sung or spoken from the lips of God's people. They come from our lips in this place. And yet this king, delivered by God to save people from their enemies, to save them from themselves, he still wouldn't be enough. One greater still is needed, and one greater has come. What's the point in reading story after story about kings that let us down? And make no mistake, King David let us down. Isn't it that our hearts long for a king that we still cannot find? Because we look for kings in all the wrong places. The kings of this world are powerful, and they will always use their power in ways that manipulate and use the powerless. Case in point, David. The strong will always grow their strength off the backs of the weak. The rich will always grow their wealth off the backs of the poor. That is the way of the world. And God's kingdom says, nope, there's a better king. Not a king who finds his loyal subjects expendable for his own glory, but he's one who laid aside his glory and who would pour out his life for his people. A better king has come who would exchange his throne for a manger, his crown of heaven for a crown of thorns, his royal scepter for a cross. As one theologian puts it, his cross is the dominating characteristic of his royal rule. That is the king that we have in David's greater son, Jesus. A king who would lay his life down so that his subject, so that we might find our life in him. So what's the conclusion of this story? This drama. So ultimately, a better king has come. A king who's worthy of our love. A king who is worthy of our allegiance. A king who is worthy for that longing for a king that is deep within the human heart. Let us pray.